Well, let's look at Revelation chapter 18 together. Do you have it open in front of you? It has to be one of the best known and most loved war films ever made. With an all-star cast headed by the young Steve McQueen, The Great Escape tells the story of the mass breakout by Allied prisoners of war towards the end of World War II. The Great Escape is based on a true story, based very closely, with the exception, that is, of the iconic scenes of McQueen riding around on his motorbike, which are completely gratuitous, are pure Hollywood, and were added at his own request. There really was an escape from this camp, which had been built specially to house the difficult cases. There really was a series of tunnels known as Tom, Dick and Harry, which were constructed with astonishing ingenuity and concealed from the guards with absolute brilliance. There really were hundreds of forged documents of many different kinds, so that the escapers would have a chance of making it across Germany and occupied Europe to safety. There were tiny compasses made from broken gramophone records and tiny slivers of magnetized razor blade. There was ventilation and even electric lighting inside the tunnels. And in all, fully 600 prisoners were involved in either making the escape or supporting it in one way or another. And one night in March 1944, 76 men succeeded in escaping through the tunnel called Harry, all 336 feet of it, and getting away from the camp. 76 got out before the guards stumbled on the outer end of the tunnel. But in spite of all the ingenuity, in spite of the years of effort, and it was years lavished on the building of these tunnels and the preparation of the escapers, in spite of the sometimes comical episodes which led up to the breakout, The Great Escape had a tragic and horrible aftermath. Only 3 prisoners made it to safety. The other 73 were all captured, and of those, 50 were shot by the SS in groups at the side of the road. Not all together, as the film shows, but in little groups here and there, stopped by the side of the road. What is perhaps less well known is that the story doesn't end there. After the war, special investigators were sent to the region to track down the perpetrators of the massacre. They found that some of them had died in fighting around the nearby cities at the end of the war. But of the remainder, nearly all were found. They were put on trial and convicted. 13 of them were executed. Justice was done. Now, in this passage, our God is calling us to a great escape. And this escape does not involve digging tunnels under prison wire or travelling across country with forged papers. But it's about breaking out of a city which God is going to destroy. A city where he is going to make sure that justice is executed. This chapter in Revelation is a summons to us to understand exactly what we are up against as Christians. It's a call to see clearly the terrible power of the system that Satan has set up against us. And above all, a call to make our escape from it, to get out quick. The city's name is Babylon. Babylon, the great city. Last week in chapter 17, we saw her as a woman, the great prostitute who aims to seduce us with her enticing temptations. This week in chapter 18, the picture changes from a woman to a city, and yet her identity is the same. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. And she's a city whose name resounds throughout Scripture. In fact, out of the 66 books of the Bible, Babylon is mentioned in no less than 20 of them, plus one more that's actually all about what Babylon does, but somehow manages not to mention her name. Babylon runs like a thread through the entire biblical narrative. She's found in every major division of the Bible, and she loomed large all through Israel's story. Almost from the very beginning, she has been present as the beating heart of godless rebellion. It all begins in Genesis 11 with the Tower of Babel. You remember the story. We've looked at it a couple of times in the last few years. The scheme of humanity is to build a tower that will reach up to heaven, be on a level with the gods, and make a name for themselves that will stand forever. And God looks down, and he sees the terrible potential of godless mankind, and he passes judgment. The languages are divided, and the peoples are scattered, and the half-built tower remains as their memorial. After that, not much is heard of Babylon for some time. But then during the monarchy, Babylon emerges again, first as a distant threat and then as a direct menace. In Judah, King Hezekiah hears of the new power that is rising in the east. Foolishly, he entertains visitors from there, shows them everything that he possesses. And Isaiah tells him that the time is coming when all the wealth of Jerusalem will be carted off to Babylon, along with his own descendants, and God's people will be exiled. And so it happens. They are led off across the desert, and they are marched in through the great Ishtar Gate, which is covered with pictures of Babylon's gods, making it quite clear who really rules in this place. Into the city that's dominated by the Temple of Marduk, the city whose very name recalls the first time when it shook its fist in the face of Almighty God. And there in exile, God's people have to learn what it means to live for him in Babylon. There's a man called Daniel, and he leads the way, and he shows that it's possible to serve God within the godless city, to rise to become a leader in Babylon without compromising his integrity. It's Daniel who is there when God declares his judgment on the city at King Belshazzar's feast, where a mysterious hand appears writing on the wall, words that spell Babylon's doom. Daniel has the doubtful privilege of explaining to the king what the words mean. And that very night, in 1 hour, doom has arrived. But back in Judah, even before the exile, the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah are proclaiming that the godless city will be judged. Listen to what they say and see if these words sound familiar. Isaiah 21, verse 9. Look, here comes a man in a chariot with a team of horses, and he gives back the answer. Babylon has fallen. All the images of its gods lie shattered on the grounds. And Jeremiah chapter 51, verses 6 to 9. Flee from Babylon. Run for your lives. Do not be destroyed because of her sins. It is time for the Lord's vengeance. He will pay her what she deserves. Babylon was a gold cup in the Lord's hand. She made the whole earth drunk. The nations drank her wine, therefore they have now gone mad. Babylon will suddenly fall and be broken. Wail over her. Get balm for her pain. Perhaps she can be healed. We would have healed Babylon, but she cannot be healed. Let us leave her and each go to his own land, for her judgment reaches to the skies. It rises as high as the clouds. Now, these are prophecies of Babylon's destruction, written at a time when the city was still alive and well. There are countless other references in the prophets to Babylon's overthrow, and many of them, like these two, are echoed powerfully in Revelation 18. Jeremiah calls for a great escape. And in the end, the escape comes. A remnant returns from exile, and the nation is rebuilt in Judah. But even then, the restored Jewish nation retains such a powerful sense of what Babylon means that when Peter writes his first letter 600 years later, he can write, "She who is in Babylon greets you," without any need to explain what he means. He's referring to the church in Rome, the Babylon of his own day. The heart of godless rebellion has shifted from the city that stood on the Euphrates River to the one that stands on the Tiber, where the evil emperors Nero and Domitian have their throne. And this city in Revelation 18 is not the literal earthly city of Babylon. That should be obvious. How could it be when the earthly city has long been destroyed and all that was left was ruins and a poor village? And when that Babylon had stood hundreds of miles inland. So it would have been a bit tricky for the ships and the sailors we read about here to have much to do with her. And nor is this Babylon just a code word for Rome, as some have suggested. That doesn't fit either. Oh yes, the Rome of John's day is here. And so is the Babylon that Daniel knew. And she is also Sodom and Egypt, as chapter 11 told us. And in a sense, she is also 21st century London and Bristol. For this Babylon is no one earthly city. She is every city and town that has stood in rebellion against God's. She is the real Babylon. The real Babylon. Of which the one whose ruins you can see today near Baghdad was no more than a pale copy. She is the Babylon who sits on the back of the beast, the realm of Satan. She is the world we have to live in. And this chapter, Revelation 18, is where her long story is finally brought to its conclusion. This chapter closes the circle. Let's have a look at it. Not that we're going to study every verse in detail, but we need to get the feel. In this chapter, we hear from three angels. The first one, in verses 1 to 3, declares Babylon's doom. The second one, in verses 4 to 20, describes the reactions to her downfall. And the third, in verses 21 to 24, gives us a dramatic demonstration of what her fall will mean. So the first angel, one we have not met before, comes down from heaven with God-given authority to declare judgment. And in words which are lifted almost directly from those Old Testament prophets, he loudly announces, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." 6 times that word great is applied to Babylon in this chapter. The great city that was first alluded to in chapter 11. The place where God's two faithful witnesses spoke out and were martyred. But now it's declared that her greatness is over, that all that's left is a ruin. The city that once was full of every kind of evil is abandoned to become merely a haunt for homeless demons and for carrion birds picking over the bones of the dead. She is fallen. And now the second angel speaks. That's in verses 4 and beyond. And he too begins by calling for judgment. Oh, she's so proud, this great city. I sit as queen, I'm not a widow, and I will never mourn. Well, that's rather ironic if you think back to last week. I sit as queen. She doesn't mention what she's sitting on. Or maybe she'd rather forget. And maybe, too, she'd rather not be too open about who her all-too-living husband really is. But she is proud. And she is secure, she thinks. Well, look at verse 5. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Now, what does that remind you of? Babylon the Great, Babel, whose aim was to raise a tower all the way up to heaven so that even God would see how great she was. But at the end of the age, it's not her proud tower that reaches up to heaven. It's the pile of her sins. And here is God's messenger proclaiming that they have all been remembered and every perpetrator has been tracked down and justice is going to be done. She's going to be repaid, verse 6, exactly as she has been dealing out to others. That's what double means here, an exact match. You'll see more of what she's done in a minute, but here in verse 7 we're told that she's given herself glory, which means she's made herself the centre of her world. and luxury, which is another word that appears several times here, and has the idea of sensual delight, of massive self-indulgence. And that's what it is to be godless, to put yourself in God's rightful place and to worship yourself. Exactly what Satan would like us all to be doing. That's what God sees. Those are her sins piled right up in his face. And there is simply no escape from the justice of God. We had the police helicopter over our house a few nights ago, buzzing around for ages. I don't think it was us they were looking for, but it certainly kept Andrea awake for a long time. Somehow I managed to sleep through all the noise. I don't usually. But when God looks down on the sins of this world, on the sins of Satan's realm, and brings judgment at last, it won't be possible to sleep through it. It won't be possible to miss it. And just as when Cyrus marched into Babylon on the night of Belshazzar's feast, so the great city will be brought down quickly and unexpectedly. In a chapter that's full of repetitions, we read again and again, "In 1 hour your doom has come. In 1 hour you have been brought to ruin." A literal hour of 60 minutes? Probably not, but it will be quick. And the angel gives us the reactions of three interested parties in Babylon's downfall. First, there are the kings of the earth, then there are the merchants, then there are the captains and crews of the ships. Did you notice that all three groups respond in the same way? They are all pictured standing at a distance, watching the smoke rising from the burning city. All very upset, but far too much afraid of her fate to step in and help. They know that they too are implicated in her sins. For the kings, it was her power that impressed them. Verse 10, terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, "Woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power. In 1 hour your doom has come." They were the elite of the earth who were only too glad to participate in her self-indulgence and her sinful ways. The power of this world. Does it impress you? Does it draw you in? Do you fancy having control? That's how Babylon works. For the merchants, it was her beauty that impressed them. Verse 15, the merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, "Woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour such great wealth has been brought to ruin." Verse 16 is carried over almost exactly from the description of the woman in the previous chapter. And it's not surprising the merchants are worried about that, because they were the ones who had sold her all this expensive stuff. Verses 12 to 13 give us the list, and it's an impressive one too. Every kind of valuable and expensive commodity from every part of the known world. Incense from as far away as Arabia and Somalia. Precious stones from India. Pearls from the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. Gold from Spain, and so on and on. And they're upset because suddenly their markets have vanished. No one to buy their cargoes anymore. Are you impressed by luxury? Fine fashions? Jewelry? The latest look? Does that draw you in? That's how Babylon works. Before we feel too sorry for these merchants, have a closer look at the last item in their cargo manifest. Verse 13, we read about horses and carriages and then bodies and souls of men. These are no innocent traders making an honest living from their buying and selling. They are slavers, quite happy to regard human lives as a commodity on just the same level as metals or wood or foodstuffs. Babylon just keeps on buying. callous and unjust as she is. Sweatshops in the Far East? What do you mean human rights? It's just business. What do you mean fair trade? It's just the free market, my friend. And the last group are the sea captains and their crews. They are simply devastated at the loss of this great city with all its opportunities for getting rich quick. Verse 18, when they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, "Was there ever a city like this great city?" They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, "Woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she has been brought to ruin." What has happened, you see, is that Babylon has got everyone firmly caught in her net. Her system traps everyone. They are all so admiring and so dependent. They don't love her. None of them steps in to try to prevent her fall. But this is how Babylon works. Everyone is involved. Everyone is sucked in. And so finally the third angel puts in an appearance. But he doesn't just speak of the city's downfall, he acts it out. Verse 21. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, "With such violence the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again." Actually, there's a very similar picture in Jeremiah where a man heading for Babylon is told to take a scroll containing words of judgment, read it out loud, then tie it to a stone and throw it into the Euphrates as a sign that Babylon will never rise again. But this angel goes one better. Instead of picking up some pebble by the side of the river, he grabs a boulder the size of a millstone, weighing hundreds of pounds, and hurls it not into a river where it might get dredged up again, but far out into the depths of a sea. And as John sees this boulder disappear beneath the water and the last ripples dying away, he knows that the city it represents has gone for good. Item by item, the angel declares the end of the life of a bustling city. Music becomes silence forever. The tools of every trade fall to the floor, never to be picked up. The production of food ceases for good. Every lamp is extinguished. Darkness falls. Wedding bells will never ring here again. And the closing epitaph, as God pulls the plug on Babylon forever, is this: "In her was found the blood of prophets and of the saints, and of all who've been killed on the earth." The greatest condemnation of all on Babylon is that she hated the Church of Christ and rejected and persecuted his people. That's simply a measure of how much the Lord loves us, how much we are worth to him. We cost him the suffering and death of his Son, and God is angry when anyone lays a finger on us. And so Babylon, the loser, disappears into final darkness and silence. Her story is ended at last, and she will never be heard of again. Do you understand Babylon? When we saw her as the ugly prostitute seated on the beasts, we could see she was a mockery of the beautiful bride of Christ. And now when we see her as the godless city who enslaves the people of the earth, we can see she is a mockery of the beautiful city of God, the new Jerusalem that we'll meet in chapter 21. She's a mockery of the church, Satan's anti-church. And just as the woman ended up being destroyed, so does the city. Babylon is not just ruined, but vanishes without leaving a trace in eternity, while our city stands forever. What is Babylon? She is everything and everyone who opposes our God, who does not belong to our Lord Jesus. She is all that our God is not. She is putting ourselves in the place of God. She is the callousness and cynicism of this world, which does not care about justice and fairness, as long as she can have whatever she wants, now. She is a rich country that is happy to steal from a poor one to make herself even richer. She is the self-indulgence of a society that demands to be entertained 24 hours a day on 80 different channels, that demands that every whim be satisfied, that throws off every restraint in pursuit of her pleasure, that will laugh at God and mock his people and acknowledge no rule or law but her own. Now, does that remind you of anything? Does that sound like anywhere you know? Worse still, does any of it sound like you? Babylon in Bristol? When we were meeting at Riverside about 4 years ago, I was preaching in Daniel, which is all about Babylon. And I alluded then to the highly objectionable banner that was hanging nearby on the building which stood as the gateway to Bristol, a poster 30 feet high that celebrated the gods of consumerism. You may remember the one. Just as Babylon's gateway in Daniel's time proclaimed its allegiance to its own false gods. So it seems quite fitting that as I come to preach on the final downfall of Babylon, not only is that poster long gone, but even the building it was hanging from is being demolished. Unfortunately, the only reason it's being demolished is to make way for the new £500 million development of Broadmead, which will make this city's love for its gods clearer than ever. And that's where the people of Bristol will go to worship the only gods they know. And any city that can cheerfully put on Jerry Springer the Opera and defend its blasphemies as free speech is getting pretty close to Babylon. When the Rastafarians say that we're living in Babylon, they are right. And this is where they got it from. My friends, do we understand the place that we live in? Do we see the false gods its people worship? Do we see what makes it tick? So what are we to do? We're like Daniel. We have no choice. We have to live in Babylon, like it or not. And how could we share our hope in Christ if we did all go off and live on a desert island somewhere? Well, this chapter gives us believers just two commands. One of them is in verse 20, which goes like this. Rejoice over her, O heaven, rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you. The NIV is certainly wrong to include this verse in what the captains and seamen say about Babylon. They have neither the inclination nor the insight to invite us to rejoice over her fall. No, this is the angel calling on heaven and all God's people to be thoroughly glad that Babylon is being judged. It takes us back to chapter 15 and the Song of the Winners, the song that we will be singing when we contemplate God's judgment on all evil. And when we see it from heaven with our sight no longer clouded by sin, we will rejoice at what he is doing. And we can start to rejoice now that none of the evil we see in our world is going to escape his notice. Be glad that the people who have exploited the poor and lived in luxury while others suffered are going to be held to account. Be glad that the authorities who persecute our brothers and sisters in Indonesia and Iran and China are not going to get away with it. And be glad simply that the evil in the world is not going to carry on forever. The day is coming when God will bring it to an end. Evil does not go on multiplying for eternity, and Satan's realm does not last for all time. That is good news. Only God's kingdom, only the heavenly city stands forever. Rejoice, because God has judged her. That's one command. And the other, it's the great escape. Verse 4. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. in words that echo through the centuries, words first written for God's people when they